Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
What role do curses play in literature? Julian Lucas joins us to talk about curses and blessings in four recent books by African women. How does a hard-nosed journalist almost marry a congenital liar and con man? Abby Allen will join us to talk about her book, Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married. Alexander Alter will be here to talk about the latest in publishing news. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast. I'm Pamela Paul. Julian Lucas joins us now. He is a contributing writer for the Book Review, and this week he looks at the role of curses in literature and specifically in contemporary African literature. And we're going to talk about four books specifically: Kintu by Jennifer Nansubuga Mukumbi, She Would Be King by Wayetu Moore, Season of the Shadow by Leonora Miano, and a memoir by Scholastique Mukasanga called The Barefoot Woman. Julian, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Pamela.
So let's just start with a very basic idea of curses. I think most of us probably think of curses as biblical or going back to the ancient. But what is a curse exactly?
So I think a curse is a kind of story that we tell when there is a misfortune of such size that is so far out of the ordinary that it requires a deeper kind of explanation, a narrative explanation that goes beyond what is visible, goes beyond the particular circumstances, and identifies an origin for misfortune.
So it's a kind of explanation for something
exactly.
That goes wrong. And what forms do they traditionally take in literature?
Curses are often features of family novels, from Faulkner's great novels to Nathaniel Hawthorne's House of Seven Gables. Often the curse can provide a kind of central motif that explains what binds the family together for generations, repeated events, things that happen to people because their ancestor did such and such.
So they're not necessarily sort of theological or spiritual or mythological in nature.
Not always, but in origin, they are. In the Bible, often when a group of people is given a distinctive character, it's because of the action of some ancestor of theirs. And interpretations of Scripture have expanded that, often in very damaging ways, using biblical curses to slander certain groups of people.
And as a kind of tool in literature, I mean, it generally will then, it sort of can set off and drive a story.
Exactly. You know, one of my favorite critics, Frank Kermode, in his book, A Sense of the Ending, which Julian Barnes cribbed his title from, he writes that we create narratives to feel connected to the beginning and the end, and particularly the beginning and the end of the grand sweep of history, stories that transcend our own lives so profoundly that we need particular way in to those stories, and curses often provide that way in.
All right. I want to talk about these specific books, but before I go into that, they are all about Africa. Are the authors all African?
Yes, the authors are all from African countries.
Okay. The novels among these are really kind of sweeping epic historical novels. And the memoir is also about a period, obviously, in Rwandan history. And all of them are about family.
Yes. And they're all kind of contending with telling very particular histories of Rwanda, of Uganda, of Cameroon, and of Liberia. But they're also working themselves out from under more generalized notions of African history and notions of African history that have actually been informed by the idea of the curse. So In the Bible, one of the most opaque and damaging curses is what's become known as the curse of Ham. Noah is asleep and hungover after the flood has occurred, and his son Ham sees him undressed, asleep. And when Noah awakens and sees that his son Ham has witnessed this, he curses Ham's son Canaan, not even Ham himself, but his son Canaan, to be a servant unto servants and for his descendants to be servants unto servants. And even though there's no real reference to a particular group of people in the scriptural original, that story has been associated with Africans since at least the medieval period by both Muslim, Jewish, and Christian commentators. It's been used as a justification for slavery, both the Atlantic slave trade and the slave trade in the Sahara in the Islamic world. And to me, it struck me how powerful an interpretation of a curse narrative could be, that it could end up defining a group of people in such a damaging way. So all of these books are in a certain way working themselves out from under these generalized notions of African history.
Let's start with Kintu by Jennifer Nansubuga Mukumbi. So this is a novel about Uganda. And is this historical fiction? Is it sort of magical realism? What's the style of the writing?
So it's very much realist fiction with a historical component. There's a prologue that takes place in the 18th century where the kind of patriarch of the story, Chintu Kida, he is managing this very large family in this very volatile kingdom. He has twin wives. He has many, many children, one of whom is adopted. And basically, through a series of missteps, he ends up accidentally killing one of his adopted sons. And this causes a chain reaction of events that results in the adopted son's birth father cursing him and his family. And we then skip ahead to contemporary Uganda. So there's no real explanation of what is the metaphysical reality of this curse. It reappears in events that happen to this man's descendants in their struggles with mental illness and with family dynamics. But whether or not the curse is real is somewhat left to the reader.
And what are the implications of the curse on the story and on this extended family?
One way in which the curse manifests is in relationships between twins. So the strained relationship between the first protagonist's twin wives repeats itself in twin relationships in the future. And often these are twin relationships that end up dividing a family in a particular way. So there is one section of the novel where one of Kintu's descendants, Kanani, which is actually a reference to the curse of Ham because his name is Canaan, but it's pronounced Kanani. He is a devout Christian, and he belongs to a church that considers itself to be awakened. And he doesn't really associate with the family. He doesn't really believe in the curse, and he believes that his faith will rescue him from this curse. And he has children who end up getting to know a sister of his who he thinks of as a pagan, and she lives in the countryside. And so when his children go to live with her, they begin changing. They begin experiencing repetitions of and connections to the history that is laid out in the prologue. And this causes a lot of dissension in the family.
So this is fairly overtly a sort of reimagining of the story of the curse of Ham.
Somewhat, yes. So the epigraph of the novel is actually, "I profess accurately to describe naked Africa. If the picture be a dark one, we should, when contemplating these sons of Noah, try and carry our mind back to that time when our poor elder brother Ham was cursed by his father and condemned to be the slave of both Shem and Japheth. For as they were then, so they appear to be now, a striking existing proof of the Holy Scriptures." And this is from this explorer, John Hanning Speke. And the kind of joke of that is how completely she avoids that curse narrative and substitutes her own. And where the curse of Ham that's invoked in that epigraph was used to stereotype Africans as having characteristics that and a condition that originates in the Bible. Chintu's curse is much more about how groups of people do not come together into a monolithic, cohesive whole. It's about how families create chaos and diversity just through their own internal dynamics, and how this also resonates in the divisions in nations, in groups of people more broadly.
And so if this novel is a kind of reimagining of this curse, or sort of turning it over, I don't know if it's turning it on its head really, but sort of rethinking it and looking at it in a purely African context where you literally take colonial history out. I want to move then to Way to Moore's She Would Be King, because this also does something very interesting that, again, is a perspective that we might not think of often here in the States, which is looking at the relationships between, in Liberia, the Liberian immigrants from America and the people who were there already.
That's really what fascinates me about Moore's book. We have so many epics that are about the African diaspora. They tend to begin in Africa and end in the New World, where whether they're Caribbean novels, whether they're American novels like Yajiasi's Homegoing. And one of the most interesting things to me about She Would Be King is that it's in the tradition of that Afro-diasporic epic, but where everything comes together is not the New World. It's in Liberia, which of course was established as a colony by the American Colonization Society. That organization was an interesting mix of free Black Americans and white abolitionists in some cases, and in other cases, slaveholders who basically believed that Africans should be sent back to Africa.
We're talking about the first half of the 19th century.
Right, in the first half of the 19th century. And so it was an organization that combined the utopian and millenarian hopes of African Americans in some cases, but also the racism and the xenophobia of certain whites who saw this as, so it was a kind of strange bedfellows in this organization. But what came out of it was the colony of Liberia, which later became the nation of Liberia, Africa's first republic. And Liberia, established by African Americans with a kind of capital at Monrovia, first with oversight from this organization, the American Colonization Society, but later an independent nation, also entered into relationships with indigenous groups there. And often it was one of cooperation, but often it was also one of conflict. And this is one that Moore's novel touches on somewhat. So the novel is structured around three characters who are all cursed in a certain way, though they're cursed, I say, more in the vein of the X-Men,
right,
than in the vein of Ham or of Cain in the Bible. The main character is Bessa, who comes from this group, the Vai people in Liberia, an indigenous group. And she's considered a witch because she's born on a cursed day. And it turns out that she has a kind of power of immortality. And she later ends up coming together with the two other characters, Norman Aragon, who is a Maroon from Jamaica. The Maroons were a group of runaway slaves who lived in what was called the kind of cockpit country, the very hilly, very heavily forested area of Jamaica, and created societies of their own there, often raiding the larger colonial areas. So there's a character, Norman Aragon, who comes from those people. And he has a power of invisibility, which sort of is an allegory for the cunning of this group, the Maroons, how they were able to create their own independent societies in the midst of these colonial societies based on slavery. And then the third protagonist, June Day, is an African-American slave from Virginia. And his power is, he's extremely strong and he's invincible in combat. And so through...
He's Wolverine.
He's the Wolverine of the group, exactly. And through a kind of chain of events, the three of these characters end up united in Liberia in a kind of allegory for the way that nation brings together the diaspora.
That really, again, takes us very naturally to the next book that you wrote about, Leonora Miano's Season of the Shadow, because there, too, she's looking at a part of the African experience that I think tends to get ignored in the American telling, which is not about the enslaved people who left Africa, but instead about those who were left behind.
I don't know of any other novels that take this perspective. So Season of the Shadow is about a village in what is now Cameroon, where 12 young men, or 10 young men and two older men who were initiating them, disappear.
Even that is just so haunting, the idea that they're just gone.
Exactly. And this is really this is the next generation in the novel, is part of what makes it so traumatic for this village. And, you know, as readers, we know that in some way they've ended up in the slave trade. But the inhabitants of this village, they are afraid to look at what might have happened. It's an isolated village. They would prefer not to look into what might be coming for all of them, which is, of course, a universal human tendency. And as often happens, they turn to scapegoating. So the mothers of the young men who have disappeared, first they gather together in a communal dwelling for solidarity, but it quickly becomes a kind of ostracism as elements in the elders' council begin to blame them for what's happened. Some of the characters, one of the mothers, as well as a kind of rival for the chieftaincy of the village, and one other character, go out to kind of investigate what's happened. And part of what gives this novel its power is the just gradual revelation that what seems to be a small anomalous disappearance is actually the beginning of this immense event, the Atlantic slave trade, which would have tens of millions of victims over 4 centuries.
There's a powerful line in your review where you say that it's often the most vulnerable, those thought cursed because of circumstance, who first apprehend threats endangering everyone. So,
exactly. And to return to the idea of the curse, this is not a novel where a quote-unquote real curse is acting. It's a novel in which those who are afraid of facing reality blame it on a group of people who are, in fact, the first sufferers. And these women are identified as bearers of malefic energies in the book and quarantined. And if there is a moral to the story, it's that ignoring the most vulnerable and blaming them for their own problems is often a recipe for being swept up in those same problems yourself, which is exactly what happens to the village in ways that I won't get into as not to spoil the novel.
In the last book, there's also this idea of inherited curses, of generations sort of passing down some form of, what call it, bad luck or, fate. The Barefoot Woman by Scholastique Mukasanga. Tell us a little bit about this memoir. We talked about it earlier on an earlier podcast. Carl Siegel reviewed it for The Times in the daily paper. Set this in terms of the theme of your essay about curses.
This is an interesting case. When Rwanda was first contacted by European powers, it was one of the last regions of Africa, and Mukasanga has written about this in essays. It was one of the last regions to be contacted by European powers. And at the time, there was a reigning idea of racial origin, that a very racist idea that the greatest accomplishments of non-Western societies could be traced to ancestry that was in some way white. And this is actually a kind of different take on the curse of Ham, because the German and then Belgian explorers and administrators who arrived in Rwanda, they decided that the kind of upper caste in Rwandan society, the Tutsis, were not truly African. They were not truly Negroes. In fact, they were descendants of Ham, and thus descendants of Noah, and from this biblical lineage that was separate. And so in this case, being identified as Hamites was in fact a privilege, a very illusory privilege, as I say in the essay.
This was an explanation for why they were the ruling class over the Hutus in Rwanda.
Exactly. This was the explanation that the European colonial rulers, German and then Belgian, came to. So it was an existing kind of caste division, and this idea that the Tutsis were Hamitic, descendants of Ham, became the basis for turning this into a racial division that was the structuring divide of colonial society. Now, when Rwanda became an independent country in the late 1960s and early 1970s, it was a kind of gradual process. There was a nationalist movement, a Hutu nationalist movement. And the divisions flipped. And this is the Rwanda in which Scholastic Mukasanga grew up in which many Tutsis, particularly those who had been involved in the colonial administration, were exiled to an arid region of Rwanda called Bujesera. And so this memoir, Barefoot Woman, is about Mukasanga growing up in one of the refugee villages, two of them actually, in this region. And it's really a tribute to her mother. And it's a tribute to the way that her mother maintained the traditions of the old Rwanda they had come from in these extraordinarily straitened and dangerous circumstances of exile, of really a kind of apartheid.
In your discussion of this last book of Scholastique Mukasanga's The Barefoot Woman, you talk about the ways in which a curse can sort of be turned into a kind of blessing. How does that manifest in The Barefoot Woman?
What I identify as one of the major tensions of the book is that, on the one hand, this is Mukasanga's memory of growing up and of her mother maintaining these traditions, particularly the traditions of Rwandan Tutsi women that she had known as a young girl, and how important these were to Mukasanga growing up and then later on after she lost so many of her family members to the genocide, just how important this transmission of heritage was, how it was a strike against the aims of the genocide, which was to eradicate Rwandan Tutsis. At the same time, inseparable from this heritage, inseparable from these traditions, are the distortions of those that were introduced by colonialism. So being proud of one's heritage, it involved a kind of connection also to this more burdensome part of the past. And one of the most painful parts of the memoir is when Mukasanga remembers that her mother believed some of the harmful colonial distortions of Tutsi heritage that had been created, that she believed that we Tutsis we're separate. We're not really from Rwanda. We're from elsewhere. And there's a kind of immense pain around the fact that her mother believed in some of the mythology that led to her being killed in the 1994 genocide. And as for that tradition also being a blessing, I think there's a way in which the stigmas that come out of that, the exile that comes out of that, the immense pain that comes out of that, that tradition also contains for Mukasanga the resources for surviving that. So near the end of the novel, there's an event that really moved me where one of the young women in the village is raped by one of the soldiers at a nearby camp, a soldier who kind of viewed these Tutsi refugees as disposable, as people you could do whatever you wanted with. And traditionally, women who bore children out of wedlock were expelled from the community, ostracized. But in this case, the women of the community, led by Mukasanga's mother, recognizing the pain of what had happened, they tried to find a way that they could welcome this woman and her child into the community, despite what had happened, and heal what had happened to her in a certain way. And so there's sort of a ritual is performed where the mother and her child go to a sacred spring that is associated with Rwanda's legendary founder, and they're both kind of washed in the water of the spring and brought back to the community. And this is kind of the penultimate image in Barefoot Woman. And it was very powerful to me because...
goosebumps.
Right. It's an incredibly painful story. And I should emphasize that, you know, the redemptive elements of this story do not erase the pain and the really inconceivable loss, but it was, to me, a powerful image of how the very tradition that can impose a stigma can also provide a way of surviving, a way of dealing. And the tradition is also something that can always be reinvented. Just as curse narratives are, even though they've been so ruinous historically for so many groups of people, for this generation of writers, they've provided ways to rewrite those histories and write more particular histories of their countries that redeem them from this narrative.
And really kind of take back the narrative from colonial tellers of these stories to provide their own perspectives in all four cases.
Exactly. All four of these writers have taken a form and a motif that has traditionally been used to apply a stigma and to generalize about African history, and they've used it to tell extremely particular stories about their countries and redemptive stories about their countries.
The four books we're talking about again are Kintu by Jennifer Nansubuga Mukumbi, She Would Be King by Way Too Moore, Season of the Shadow by Leonora Miano, and The Barefoot Woman by Scholastique Mukasanga. One last question. These are all books clearly by Africans, some of them no longer living in Africa, but by Africans and also by African women.
Yes.
Is there anything to be said about the fact that they're not explicitly all about women? They are all written by women. What do you make of that?
So I spoke earlier about the curse of Ham. There's also historically an idea that women are a cursed gender. And I cite early in the essay the Roman theologian Tertullian, who kind of infamously read the story of Genesis as Eve's fault and said that women are the gateway of the devil, the gateway to hell. And all of these books engage not only with stigma applied to Africans, but stigma applied to women, and also the kind of solidarity that can come out of that and the particular forms of insight. So Mukasanga's Barefoot Woman is very much about the community of women in the villages where she grew up, the kind of women's parliaments that would be held with pipe smoking and discussions of who should marry whom and how the village should be protected from the nearby soldiers. This is also, of course, an element of Miano's Season of the Shadow, these mothers who are ostracized, but also it's one of these mothers who this experience is exactly what gives her the insight to discover what's really going on, to discover the traces of the slave trade that is coming. In She Would Be King, there is Bessa being identified as a witch by her community, and then when she kind of marries into the community of Americo-Liberian, the kind of African-American settlers, there's also a difficulty of the way she's treated for being the wife of one of these settlers. And in Chintu, gender is also a big part of the narrative, but it's actually very much a book that's about the toll that patriarchy takes on men. And the kind of main figure in the prologue, this 18th century Baganda nobleman, one of the origins of the curse is that he is so overwhelmed by his responsibilities as a father, as a husband to many different women, and as a
diplomat.
It's
hard having all those wives.
Well, this is, he's described as a seed dispenser in one part of the novel. But Chintu is much more about the difficulties that gender roles impose on both men and women, just the kind of difficulties imposed by patriarchy on everyone.
All right. Julian, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Pam.
Julian Lucas is a contributing writer for The Book Review, and this week he has a cover essay looking at four recent books by African women.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. Abby Ellen joins us now. Her new book is called Duped: Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married. Abby, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. I have to start with the obvious question, which is you are a journalist, which means you are a skeptic. You have interviewed people who are slippery. You've figured them out. You have translated it into plain English for all of us. You've written an expose of LASIK surgery. Like, how does someone like you get duped?
But I didn't date them. These were not people that I was intimately involved with. I just reported on them. How did somebody get duped? Because it's exactly what you're saying about being a journalist and being a person. At some point, you say, you know what, maybe if I want to have a romantic life, if I want to have a personal life, I'm going to have to curb my natural skepticism. I'm going to have to stop the interrogation and just learn to trust and learn to suspend my disbelief. And so that is what I did. Also, when somebody is lying to you about being in the CIA and being a Navy SEAL and being responsible for this secret operation and that secret operation, you can't verify it. And so if you want to verify it, even if I wanted to, it would have been hard. And also, I didn't think that was a loving way to kick off a relationship.
All right, let's start with the beginning of the relationship.
Okay.
Who is this guy? How did you meet? Where were you?
I met him. He was a source, but not when we were not dating when he was a source. I met him. I was reporting a piece, and I needed a doctor to quote it, to give me a quote. And so I found this doctor over the phone. And he was in private practice in California. And so we spoke, and the story didn't run for a year. And that was it. Didn't talk to him again. Called a year later to fact check. He said he had moved. He was back. He was in the Navy now, and he had left private practice, and that he was working on a project that had to do with helping kids with cancer, opening a hospital in Iraq and Afghanistan. And coincidentally, he was living in, going to move to Washington to work at the Pentagon. And I was changing my life. I was going to Johns Hopkins to study international relations. And so I thought, well, isn't that a coincidence? And we started talking more after that, just talking very professionally. And then it started to turn a little bit personal, but I'd never met him in person, so I didn't know. But that's sort of what happened. We got to know each other on the phone, and I thought, okay, this is the way you meet somebody. This is nice. We're meeting. We're getting to know each other. We're talking. We're not in a drunken bar, you know, that kind of
and
thing.
And so you had never met him?
I'd never met him. Not only that, there really weren't very many pictures of him online. And he later said, well, you know, that's because I'm undercover, and I can't have a profile online.
All right, so how do you meet, finally?
We finally meet. He says, I have to come to New York to address the United Nations. I said, okay. He said, so let's go somewhere celebratory. I said, okay. So, you know, we went to the Four Seasons when it was still around, and we had dinner, and it was very nice. It was very nice. He was in his Navy whites. You know, and I know nothing about the military. I grew up in
so he could have, like, ordered
Brooklyn.
This thing online somewhere you would not know.
Exactly right. And I think he actually ended up doing that with some of his insignia stuff. I don't know.
On eBay.
On eBay. I don't know enough about it. And we had a nice time. He told me some things that were sounded very strange to me. But again, I was actively trying to curb my disbelief.
You were trying to lower your inhibitions.
I was trying to lower my inhibitions, and I was trying to not be the skeptical, cynical journalist. Because I thought, you know, I'm not one of these people that the universe has a message for me. Because if that's the universe's focus, then the universe's priorities are out of whack. But I think that, you know, there are lessons that you can take away. And the lesson that I was trying to takeaway was there are things you will not know. You cannot know everything.
So, of course, you look back now and there are little red flags. What were the red flags?
Red, pink, maroon, magenta. There were flags. He told me that he had treated very important terrorists at Guantanamo, where he had been the medical director. The thing is that actually he was a medical director there. That was so interesting. For a time, he was. He mixed his fiction and his nonfiction. You know, Oprah would have kicked him off her bestseller, her book club. I mean, you know, he wasn't telling the complete truth, but he wasn't completely lying. He told me that he had met his ex-wife when he rescued her when she was held hostage in Iran. And I said, when were we in Iran? And he said, no, it was a secret mission. You would never have heard about it. He had nightmares in the middle of the night, and he screamed bloody murder. And I said, why? What is going on? He said, I was held hostage in China. And they beat me. And that is why I have to sleep with a Food Network blaring and with the lights on because I'm afraid of the dark.
If it were me, I would want like a timeline. Did you ever just say like, okay, wait, so you were in China and then you were in Iran and like and yes. did it all work together? Did it fit?
There was a few years that were unaccounted for. It did work because he had been in a pole vaulting accident. So he had left college.
Is that true?
That is true. Well, pole vaulting, I don't know, but I know that he had stomach issues because I later contacted his ex-wife and then his ex-ex-wife, whom I didn't know about. And that was all true. He had stomach problems. You know, he said he had been shot. I don't think he'd been shot. I don't think that wasn't true. Not I don't think. That wasn't true. I asked for timelines. He also said that he had an uncle. This is what he said. He had an uncle and the uncle was doing work for the Mossad. And when this guy, the commander, as I called him, was a teenager, he was recruited by this uncle and that he had this medal from Golda Meir. Okay? These things, because he was an older guy, and these things.
How old was he?
Well, I was 42. He was 58. So that was older. And he's older still now. None of it made sense. It didn't make sense to me. And yet. Somebody has to do this stuff, right? And so what better than a nerdy, asthmatic, you know, guy with bad posture?
But he really was a doctor.
He really was a doctor, and he really was in the military. He was in the Navy, but he had never been a SEAL, and he was not working for the CIA, and his wife had never set foot in Iran.
Okay, so how long did you date him?
1 year.
And you got engaged?
So my parents met at Grossinger's, and they got married after 3 months. 52 years later, and 3 kids, they are still together, okay? So I thought, I'm 42 years old, you know, I've dated enough, I've been independent, I've done whatever I needed to do, I've happily lived my life, maybe now I should grow up. I was 42, that was not young. So I met this guy, and he was nothing like I ever expected or wanted. He was not my type. You know, he liked the music of Bread, like, unironically. I mean, yeah, that's not my type. But I thought this is what you do. You compromise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if your compromises involves, this is a guy who screams in the middle of the night. Okay, you get separate bedrooms. You know, there are compromises. He was good. He was decent. He was smart. He was funny. And man, did he adore me, allegedly. So I thought, okay, it's time I'm serious. So he proposes to me after 6 months. And I thought, okay, my parents got married after 3 months. We'll do it. Mm-hmm. But we hadn't lived together and we actually hadn't been in the same city because he was in Washington. I was in New York on my way to Johns Hopkins. So by the time it's summertime and I'm getting ready to move there, we get a place in, where else do you live? The Watergate, ground zero for deception. And we get a place there. It was hilarious. And the median age is deceased. And we go there and he was a drag. He was difficult. He was unreliable. He would fall asleep at dinner. All of these things. And it turned out he was, in addition to being a liar, he was an addict. And so that's finally what nailed him.
Wow.
He was writing prescriptions for narcotics, Vicodin, and he was using all these people's names of people he worked with at the Pentagon, which he really did, and my name. And his dead uncle and his father-in-law and, you know, all these people, his ex-father-in-law. And I got a phone call from NCIS one day. It was a year and a half after I left him.
NCIS?
Naval Criminal Investigative Service. Not Mark Harmon. This was Special Agent Dan Ryan. And he called me up. He said, there's this doctor who's writing prescriptions for Vicodin. Do you know him? And do you have a prescription? And I said, I know him. And no, I like Valium. I don't have a prescription for Vicodin. And I was elated. I was elated because all my suspicions and everything that didn't make sense, you know, and my mother said, Abby, something's wrong with this guy. When I told her about the very important terrorists, she said, something's not right. And I got mad at her. I said, you are so suspicious. It's your fault that I don't trust anybody. And she was right.
You were elated, not relieved.
No, I was elated. I felt like Carrie in Homeland, that episode where she discovers that Brody really is, you know, working for the bad guys. And she says, I was right. That's how I felt.
It's interesting. It's like the journalist, in a way, won out over the person
Absolutely.
Wanting to fall in love.
Absolutely. I think that's the lesson that you said that very nicely, Pamela. Yeah, I think that's what it was. I just thought my instinct, God, I have a good gut.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that killed us was not journalistic, though. The thing that when I finally said, I'm done here, was something that I could verify, which was we went out to dinner with my parents and we had Brussels sprouts and he raved about them. They were the culinary love child of, you know, Mario Batali and, I don't know, Julia Child. And we got out and he said, God, that was awful. It was the most terrible meal ever. And I said, why did you lie? My parents didn't cook it. They don't care. He said, I wanted to make them feel good. And I thought, if he's lying about something so inconsequential, he can lie about anything. And that was
it. And is that why he lied? To make people feel good?
I think, well, he lied to make himself feel good and he lied to make other people feel good too. Yeah. But that's sort of a male thing. Women tell lies to make other people feel good. Mm-hmm. Men tell lies to make themselves feel good.
So how did it end?
Well, I said, I'm out.
Right,
I can't
then,
do this anymore.
The Brussels sprouts.
Basically, I said I'm out, and a month later was really the finale. The grand finale was when I had this ring that he'd given me, and his son, who allegedly had known we were engaged, said, I was in his house, his brother and sister-in-law's house in Washington for Christmas, and his kids were there. And the son, I overheard him saying, what's that on Abby's finger? Is that from you? And I thought, the kid knew this. Why would he say that? And so I said to the commander, I said, what is that about? He said he forgot. I said, kids don't forget that their parents are getting remarried. So that was it. So I was done. And that New Year's Eve, this was New Year's Eve 2010 going into 11, I was in New York. I left Washington. I came back to New York because this is my people. This is where this is my New York. I'm a New Yorker. I get New York. Washington freaked me out anyway because I think about Washington and I think about the difference between New York and Washington is that in Washington, no one is who they seem to be. And in New York,
everyone lies.
And in New York, no one is who they want to be. And I get it. Like in New York, I understand aspiration and ambition, but the other thing freaked me out. So I came back here and I was with my friends and I had said, okay, you know, maybe I'll give him maybe half a chance. I said, come to New York for New Year's Eve. He said, I can't. He said, I'm working. I have to thwart a bioterrorism attack in New York City. There's somebody threatening to put chemicals in the water and I have to fix it. And I just thought, you're nuts. I'm out. I'm done. So,
did you ever confront him?
I did. But there's no point in confronting people like this. They spin and they manipulate and they gaslight and do all those things. No, I did for a long time. I did for I did for a couple of months because I knew I was going to write something, but I didn't know what. And so for a year and a half, I still didn't know if I was this terrible, mistrusting, awful human being or if he was. So
you did what you do. You reported him out, right?
I mean, you
investigated.
I waited until I got the call. And then I called his ex-wife. And then I called the woman he was with after me, who actually ended up nailing him. She helped. She wore a wire. I called the woman.
Wow.
Yep. She was spectacular.
I mean, when nailing him, did he go to prison?
2 years. Okay. I called the woman he was engaged to while he was engaged to me. It turns out that when he started courting me, he had been living with a woman in Florida who was a doctor. And he had proposed to her. And then she said yes. And a few months later, he walked out the door telling her, as he often did, that he had to go on a secret mission. And the secret mission was Operation Abby. He walked out the door. He never came back. She didn't know what mm-hmm. happened. He left 26 bags of stuff in her garage. And so I called her finally. I found out her name from his ex-wife. And she said, oh, my God, I know who you are. You wrote about him, but I didn't know that you were living with him. I didn't know what happened to him. So I got verification from her, too.
So you wrote a story?
The original story when I met him. She was living with him when I quoted him in that article. That when I later followed up to fact check, he had been living with her. So she and I are now friends. And then I found out that he had had this ex-wife. So I called her out of the blue. And you know, that was hard. I didn't want to upset anybody. It was obviously traumatic for them. And, you know, we are lucky. We can write. I have this ability and I have this platform. Even if I put myself out there and I look like an idiot, you know, which I know I'm people are going to say, which is fine, let them. But, and a lot of women and men don't have a platform. They don't have a way to make sense of what happened to them. I'm lucky that I do.
So these, the ex-wife and the ex-ex-wife, did they know, had they realized that he was a con man? So you were the person that revealed
I told it. The ex-wife got a call from NCIS, and then she realized, and then I called her up, and she's lovely, lovely, beautiful. I gotta say, he has great taste in women. We become friendly. I become friendly with all of them.
And the kids?
I haven't talked to them. There's no need. I don't want to hurt. Look, he lied to his kids. That to me is the most despicable thing. You know, his son thought he was this military hero. It was not me. He told his son that he was responsible for the bin Laden raid. You know, because that was after we broke up. He told his son that. His son thought that his father was, he wanted to be in the military just like his father.
So a lot of people, this kind of thing would happen to them, this sort of like disastrous love affair gone very, very wrong. And their first instinct would be like, oh my God, I hope no one ever finds out about this. Yeah. I'm an idiot. It makes me look, you know, gullible and foolish. And they would never talk about it ever again.
Yeah.
But you wrote about it.
My motto is monetize suffering. Yeah, I did write about it for a variety of reasons. A, because what we do is try to make sense of our lives. Mm-hmm. As narcissistic and solipsistic as that sounds, that's what we do. So, and we, again, have this platform to do it. But also, that's exactly right. People don't talk about this, and it happens all the time, Pamela. Every time I mentioned my story or what I was working on, everybody knew somebody who'd been deceived, or they had been deceived, or they had deceived. So this is everywhere. And it's not only just romantically. It's your colleague. It's your politician. It's your president. It's your former president. It's, you know, everybody knows somebody close. Mm-hmm. It's their father. They found out that their father had another family around the corner. It happens all the time. So everybody's susceptible to being duped.
So everybody lies. But what makes someone a con man? And is that different from a congenital liar, from a sociopath? Like, is there a diagnosis for this?
No, there's debate. Some people think it should be. Pathological lying should be its own diagnosis. It's not. They have psychopathic tendencies. They have psychopathic traits. You know, what it would be is actually coercive control, which is illegal in England, in the UK, but not here, which is in romantic relationships when they're manipulating and gaslighting and lying to you and making you think that there's something wrong with you. That's, you know, and it's a form of domestic violence. What makes somebody do it? They're really smart. They're really creative. I mean, you get someone like Frank Abagnale. He's brilliant. And now he's using, it's funny because
this
now.
This is the catch me if you can
guy. Catch me if you can guy. He's using his superpowers for good now. Mm-hmm. He's helping with, you know, he's working with AARP and helping with elder fraud. But for a long time, he was using his superpowers just to get one over on people.
So you go out to write this book and you did a lot of research.
Tons.
How did you look into this?
There are two kinds of people. There are people who are interested in the perps, and then there are people who are interested in the dupes. But most of the people who are interested in the dupes are people who've been duped, or we'll talk about it. And there really isn't that much focused on the quote-unquote victim. And mm-hmm. that's where I was interested in, because I've always been interested in how do you make sense of this when your life has been upended, when you find out that you have seven siblings from another family that you didn't know your father had, when you find out that your husband is, you know, embezzling all this money. How do you make sense of it? So that's what I was interested in. But I was also interested in how and why they pull it off. So I had to look at both. But my focus was really on the duped. And in fact, I was going to call it at one point the duped, because it was the people on my end mm-hmm. who don't talk about it. I was interested in how they move on. But there was an arc, which is how we lie, why we trust, why we deceive, and whom we deceive the most. And who do you think we deceive the most? Ourselves. Which is why so many people get duped, because they see what they want to see. We want to believe in love. We want to believe in happy endings, even those of us cynical journalists. I mean, I have a list in here of other journalists who've been duped, maybe not romantically, although some too.
Walter Kern, for example.
Walter Kern, who's brilliant. He was with, I mean, Clark Rockefeller, and Walter wrote a book about it, Blood Will Out. It's the same kind of thing. You know, there was Stephen Glass at the New Republic. You know, there's a history of this. It's very interesting. And the other
very
thing,
tastefully avoided naming the person of the New York Times.
Jason Blair. Jason with a Y. Yeah, but I did. But a lot of people are duped, and smart people are duped. And smart people might even be more susceptible to being duped because we are smart. And we think we're above it, and we think it's not going to happen to us, and then it does.
What did you learn about yourself from studying how and why people are duped?
That I am not a victim. I was responsible. I was, again, because of my circumstances and my job, my day job, and doing what I do, and the fact that I couldn't verify anything, even though I tried, that I still should have walked away the minute I had dinner with him. The minute I had dinner with him, the very first night of Four Seasons, because something was off, and I knew it. And I thought, this is not somebody.
So you knew it in your gut, and you dismissed the gut.
And I dismissed my gut. So what I learned is, I have a damn good gut. That's what I learned. You know, my abs are not so great at the moment, but I have a good gut. So that was great. That was really validating. I have a great gut, and my mother has a great gut. And I learned also that we are all complicit in our own, to some degree, in our own duplicity. We see what we want to see and we don't see what we don't want to see because it is to our benefit not to see it.
All right. So if someone, this is not a how-to book at all.
No.
And I'm not accusing you of writing a how-to book. Nonetheless, assuming that most of our listeners do not want to be duped, is there some piece of advice that you would give people that would lower their chances of being conned?
Beyond going with your gut, right? Beyond that, you know, move slowly. And this applies to men and women because we are seeing stories about female dupers as well. It's not like men have the lock on it. I think women are more susceptible to it romantically because there's so much more pressure on women to be coupled mm-hmm. and to be married and to be in love. And so there is this sort of, I will do anything that it takes to achieve that goal. I have written The Vows in the New York Times for a long time. And I can't tell you how many people want to be in that page. It's like, I must be in The Vows because I need to announce to the world that I've made it. No matter what else women are doing, there's still, you've reached some level of achievement if you've been married or if you've gotten married, which I've always found fascinating because that's never been how I've defined myself. But that's what I think is doing. So I would want to say to women, you know, slow down. It doesn't, if that doesn't happen, it's okay. It's okay. Loneliness is one thing. And wanting the desire for companionship is one thing. But to feel like there's something wrong with you in the culture because you haven't gotten married, to me is really problematic. And it's gotten better, but it's still, that stigma is still there.
Was it hard to get over this experience for you personally?
Was it hard? It was hard. Right after I met him, I started dating other people. You know, it was like, if you fall off the horse, get back on right away. And I started dating other people, some who were kind of, you know, they were like really sweet and I knew they weren't going to deceive me, but I also knew it wasn't long term. And then I kind of said, you know what? I'm out. I'm on a hiatus. I'm not doing this anymore. I don't need to. The best relationship I think I had was with this Brazilian when I was living in Brazil, who's 15 years younger and really doesn't speak English. It was ideal.
Because he couldn't fool you?
Because he couldn't. And if he could, I would know it. And, you know, so, and we spoke in a limited Spanish, Portuguese hybrid. I mean, it was great. So, but not nobody serious in the States. I might. I'm not opposed to it. I'm going to be very Reagan about it. Trust, but verify. And, well, maybe verify, but still don't trust.
All right, Abby, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
The book is called Duped: Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married. Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
So some interesting figures came out about book sales in 2018, and as we had suspected, they show that sales of print units continued to rise. There's been this trend of the resurgence of print as people are moving away from digital books. There's also the enormous growth of audiobooks, which I think has become the preferred digital format for a lot of readers. So these numbers came from NPD BookScan, and their final count of unit sales for 2018 showed that there were 296 million books sold. That's a 1.3% gain over 2017. So that's a significant rise in print. And it also showed that adult nonfiction was up quite a bit by 14 million units. And that's almost a 5% increase. So that was interesting to see. And we've seen, of course, a lot of the political books driving that trend. In the meantime, kind of as a corollary to that, adult fiction sales fell. They fell by 6.5 million units, and that's an almost 5% drop. So you can see that kind of eating into the market for fiction.
People have been talking about that. Just that,
publishers, agents, everyone's been concerned.
Authors.
Yes, the authors, of course, yes.
And even readers, you know, that they're glued to the real world.
Yeah, and I always thought, you know, you might want a break. You might want an escape from the news, but apparently it's just too riveting.
Apparently it's just you and me, Alexandra, that want that.
Yeah, so that was interesting. And adult hardcover sales were also very strong last year, and I think that's been a very encouraging trend for publishers because that's where they make a lot of their money with those hardcover sales, and it shows that there really is a strong appetite for new books.
How does it roughly break down these days in terms of, like, what percentage of people read carbon-based books, what percent read ebooks, and what percent read audio? I'm sure some people do all three. But, like, what's the breakdown, or the breakdown in terms of the market, and what percent are sold in those three categories?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So one way that we can look at it is through the publisher's revenue and what they're getting from various formats. And so the organization that tracks that is the Association for American Publishers. They look at publishers' revenue, and their latest figures for 2018 look from January to October. And that showed the continuation of a trend we've seen in recent years, which is that ebooks have fallen. They are now about 13.5% of revenue. They fell by 3.1% compared to the same period in 2017.
Didn't people think ebooks were going to take over?
Certainly, like 7 to 5 years ago, the theory was that within a few years, they were going to get to at least 50% of sales. So they not only tapered off, but have actually fallen. And that's been very surprising. Of course, these don't reflect self-published books, which I think still sell quite a bit.
And if it's 13% of the revenue, we have to say that a lot of those books are free or cheap or on subscription services, right? So this the revenue can be misleading.
It can be, although, you know, now that publishers set their own ebook prices, they're not as cheap as they used to be. Sometimes they cost as much as a paperback, which I think is another reason that readers have gone back to paper.
Got it.
They're no longer any cheaper. And so people feel like if they're going to spend the money, they might as well get, you know, the physical version. So continuing with kind of what formats are selling well. So hardback accounted for 37.6% of revenues in that period of 2018, and that was up 3.5% over the previous year. And of course, downloaded audio continues to show the most explosive growth of any format. Downloaded audio grew by almost 40%. It still accounts for just 6% of revenues, though. So I think there's even more room for it to grow, which is kind of interesting. I do think as people have kind of migrated away from dedicated e-readers like Nooks and Kindles, although I still use mine, I have to say, for traveling, I love it. You know, when you have one device, it's your phone, I think downloaded audio has become kind of the go-to digital format for a lot of people.
But there still are Nooks, right? Does that still exist?
Yes, they do have Nooks.
Okay.
They are in the
world.
Not yet. No.
Okay.
For publishers, I think all of this has been great. They see, you know, the resurgence of hardback in particular is adding to their revenues. But as we've talked about on the podcast before, there has been this print crunch, and it was particularly acute during the holidays because the capacity at the printing plants has decreased. And I think part of the reason it decreased was because of the expectation that ebooks would be dominant. And when that has sort of shifted, they haven't readjusted in terms of their printing capacity. And there's some other reasons that there's been a crunch. But that's kind of interesting. It'll be interesting to see how publishers kind of readjust both their print runs and just how they manage inventory in this new reality where print is resurgent.
All right. Alexandra, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues Greg Coles, Tina Jordan, and John Williams. Hi, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
All right, let's start with John, because I consider what you're reading a little bit of a betrayal.
We're going to fight. What I read this time around was Conversations with Friends by Sally Rooney, a novel that got a lot of attention last year when it was, well, I think it was published at the very end of 2017, maybe, but it got a lot of attention. And she has a new novel coming out in the spring, and so partly to prepare to read that, I read this novel in full. And what you're referring to, Pamela, is that last year at some point, I think just in the office one day, it was kind of a quiet day, and I picked it up, and I read maybe 20 or 25 pages, and I put it aside thinking, to use a very critical technical term, it was okay. But I just didn't see what the fuss was about, and so I didn't want to delve any further. And then for various reasons this weekend, I had occasion to kind of sit on my couch and just start it very quietly with nothing else to do and got
See, your weekends are different from mine already.
Same. Well,
you had occasion to sit quietly on a couch.
Those are all my weekends, I hate to say. And really got sort of under the spell of it a little bit. It is kind of a quiet book in some ways. And Rooney, I think, is 27?
27. No, that's correct. No, 27.
And so she must have written this when she was maybe 25, 24 even.
Thomas Mann, 25, when he wrote Buddenbrooks. But this is not Buddenbrooks.
Well, we won't go that far. Yeah, we're not going to fight that much. Briefly, the story is, for those who don't know, is it's narrated by a woman named Frances, a young woman in college. She's 21, and so is her good friend Bobby, another woman. And Bobby and Frances had been a couple, and now they're close friends. And they meet a woman named Melissa, who's a photographer and a journalist. And Melissa is 37, and she sort of takes them under her wing and gets to know them, and she introduces them to her husband, who's an actor, a very handsome actor, conventionally handsome in his young 30s. And essentially, Frances and the husband fall in love, and it becomes not a romantic triangle, but kind of a romantic square between the four of these characters. But it's all narrated by Frances, who is a sort of depressive writer. She's a poet, and she kind of overanalyzes everything psychologically, her relationships to other people.
And you're not selling this, I have to say, saying it's narrated by a depressive poet.
Yeah. Well, it does have a quiet... You know, I think that if you like, I mean, a favorite of mine, Anita Bruckner, there is something very mild and about it. But there's also something very precise. And I think what I was most impressed by, because I really ended up enjoying it quite a lot, is that most of the time when a person's in their mid-20s and they write a book that gets a lot of attention and that people praise, it's because there's this kind of almost uncontainable exuberance of their voice, something of White Teeth by Zadie Smith. And you say things like, there's so much energy and brilliance here, and what needs to happen is that there almost has to be more containment going forward. This is the opposite. It's like someone who's in their 50s or 60s and sits down and writes their first novel. It's very patient. It's really psychologically precise, and it is very muscularly written. There isn't much extra going on. She's really cut it down to the essentials, and I just ended up feeling like it was propulsive, even though it's a quiet novel.
It's so funny that you're reading that, because on Twitter, all of my friends who had also sort of refused to read it or had put it aside at some point have been picking it up and reading it and loving it.
I think Greg had mentioned earlier that it might be in preparation
for
the next
novel.
Yeah,
Greg, you're still on my team.
You know, like John, I did not finish this book. I started it when it came out. It was a very buzzy book when it came out. And I read further than 20 or 25 pages in. I gave it probably twice that and thought, okay, I get it. And I just never was propelled.
The stakes felt low to me.
But I never kind of, I thought, all right, I got it. And I put it back down then. She has a new book coming out this spring called Normal People, and it's, again, getting quite a lot of attention. So I may have to pick it up. John, you're selling it again.
A little bit.
Yeah, maybe I'm just too old. I mean, I had the same experience you did, Greg. I mean, I read pretty far in it. I got it. I put it down. My 25-year-old picked it up and blew through it, you know, in a couple of hours on the couch one afternoon and, like, couldn't stop talking about it.
And our colleague Lauren Christensen, who is not much older than 25 herself, was a huge fan of Conversations with Friends.
And so is Lovia Gyarki, who's even younger than Lauren. But I will say that I am much, much older than 25. And I normally hate a lot of things like this on paper. Like, if you described this book to me before I read any pages, I would have said, no way.
See, I'm
running in the opposite direction.
I think I only read 20 pages. So you're like, when does it pick up?
We were similar. We'll talk after. We'll see if Pamela
revisits this. This is the post-podcast confrontation.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when her next book comes out in April, maybe we'll all reconvene and talk about it again. But for now, Tina, what are you reading?
Okay. So I'm reading something called The Big Empty by Stan Jones. And our crime columnist, Marilyn Stasio, recommended this to me because I took a trip to Norway last year, and much of the trip was above the Arctic Circle, and I was really taken by the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to talking to her, and she knows I like thrillers, and she mentioned Stan Jones and this particular series because it's set like in far northern Alaska. And
is there a co-writer, or is Patricia Watts a character?
Patricia Watts is a co-writer on this one. It's the first time he's had a co-writer, I think. The first ones are just by him. Anyway, the main character, and I've only just started,
works for the Alaskan State Police. He's like, you know, they don't have police departments, you know, in a state that big and where things are that remote. So he oversees a large area. And I've only just gotten started. He's investigating the crash of a small plane. And, of course, up there, like when you need to go someplace, when you need to go to town.
Right, you don't drive, you fly.
You fly.
Yeah.
But it's giving me those descriptions I had hoped for, like just the vastness, the quietness.
Is there a noir feeling to it? Because the big empty is so resonant of the big sleep.
Yes, there is a noir element to it. And I think that really is the name of that part of Alaska, this sort of like place where there just aren't many people.
That's funny. Connecticut, where I live, has the quiet corner.
What is the quiet is that corner?
The quiet corner of Connecticut, I think, is mostly forest. It's just, you know, kind of sleepy. It's not a suburban area at all.
That sounds like another good setting for a crime novel.
Yeah, and I was actually curious about the author, and I went to look him up. And he's not actually from Alaska, but his parents got the Alaska bug when he was a kid and moved there, and he just became captivated. He's never left.
Greg, what about you? You have a mystery.
I do have a mystery. If you combine Tina and John, your readings, because Sally Rooney is Irish, and Tina, you're reading a mystery, I'm reading an Irish mystery. You'll remember a couple of weeks ago, I was procrastinating Ulysses with William Trevor's stories, and I said, well, at least it's Irish, so I'm kind of keeping myself in that universe. I'm still keeping myself in that universe with... I'm jumping on the Tana French bandwagon, which people in the book review all kind of jumped on last year with this book, The Witch Elm, which Stephen King reviewed on our cover. I have not read Tana French before. She's best known for her series of the Dublin Murder Squad mysteries, which, although it's a series, they could each be read as kind of standalones because they go into different characters on this Dublin Murder Squad, the police department there. But this is not part of that series. This is a standalone book about a guy named Toby who used to work publicity. When the book opens, he's still working for PR at a small art gallery, kind of a small struggling art gallery in Dublin. He's attacked by a couple of robbers right at the beginning of the book and goes to the family estate to recuperate. And the bulk of the book is about the mystery that unfolds on that estate, not about his attack. Although you get a sense that they may kind of weave together by the end, that something about the family mystery may also explain why he was attacked. There's something, it's very much, you know, a suspense novel and a crime novel and genre in that sense. But I also think it has such a sense of history and bringing in and kind of social consequence. There's a lot of kind of this Me Too stuff running through it that, in funny ways, it reminds me of a book like Song of Solomon, where it's about the past, somebody who's skated along through life, learning how the past has so much more consequence on the present than he has previously realized. And so that's what's, you know, really holding me here.
I also felt like it was just such a stunning psychological portrait of a family.
Yeah.
And how they interact with one another and who keeps secrets from whom.
She's a lovely writer, too, just at the level of the sentence. And so I said it's very much a genre novel, but it is, and it is propulsive. But it's true that most of the mystery happens at the level of the psychology.
Well, I'm the only one here who hasn't read The Witch Elm. So I'm going to move us along because I'm feeling very left out.
Pamela,
what do you have?
I read a quick little book that I read for purpose. The book is The Bonjour Effect, The Secret Codes of French Conversation Revealed by Julie Barlow and Jean-Benoît Nadeau, who wrote, I think, two books that sold very well, perhaps bestsellers, The Story of French and 60 Million Frenchmen Can't Be Wrong. And I read it with the express purpose of, I was really missing France as a former resident and someone who used to go back every 6 months or so, but long ago stopped doing that. I read it to sort of stave off my French sickness. And it did, in fact, have the opposite effect. And I think it was on page 112 that I put the book down and I bought a round-trip ticket to Paris.
Wait, you did?
I did. I did. I'm going by myself. I'm going to sleep on a friend's sofa. I just need to get back there. But so in that sense, it was totally ineffective. But it's a subject that I've always been interested in, which is the way in which language both reflects culture and also kind of drives culture. But it was totally enjoyable and informative, even as someone who speaks French and has lived there and gone to school there and worked there. There were lots of things that I learned, and they said it very much in the recent past. So it's written by this couple. They're Canadian. They are Quebecois who lived in France in 1999 and in 2001 and returned to France in 2013 with their twin adopted Haitian-Canadian daughters. And so they're seeing France through the lens now of parents and through the sort of secondary lens of their daughters. And that in certain ways reflected my own experience living in France, first as a student and then returning years later to the family that I lived with as a student. So they're seeing it through the lens of their kids and as parents, and they're getting a different slice of France, which is also a view on France that I'm kind of interested in, as well as looking in particular at the politics of the last few years. So, yeah, it didn't do what it was supposed to do, but it was completely interesting. And the title, The Bonjour Effect, is, just to explain quickly, that in France, if you do not say bonjour at the beginning of a conversation, it basically means there is no conversation, you know, and that anyone who's gone to Paris. Yeah, it's basically it's almost like a kind of like positioning. You know, there are certain phrases in other languages, like in Thai, you have what's called a politening syllable that you have to put at the end of all of your sentences. And if you're a woman, it's ka. And if it's a man, it's krap. And after a while, with deep familiarity, you can drop the ka and the krap, going from vous in French for you to tutoying someone. It's a kind of word that we think has a meaning, but it also really has a function. And this is sort of asking for permission to talk to someone. And many people who go to France who don't know this are often surprised and think, well, the French are so rude and awful. But it's really just because you didn't say bonjour and you didn't also wait for them to say bonjour back.
Well, now I need to book a ticket and go back and do it the right way. I've been to Paris once, but I don't think I did that.
Well, you read this book and then you buy your ticket. It's very effective.
Gladly.
In that way. That's the bonjour effect, in other words. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, albeit not right away. The Book Review Podcast is produced by Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with the great help of my colleague, John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.